Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money. And hold that money. And practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what happened is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we moved, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that sometimes you're right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you're driving.
That is true.
Down a superhighway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build those shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know that know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. I'm old enough to remember many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them, and there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and big, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their.
Friends, it is time once again for our daily message of hope. And with today's message, here is Richard Eaton.
Friends, to brighten your day, here is our message of hope. Do you sometimes feel sorry for yourself? Sorry for yourself because of many responsibilities, many problems, many unpleasant situations? Don't worry. Don't feel sorry for yourself. Happiness, serenity, even a more satisfying life will come to you in greater degree as the load you carry grows weightier. The natural way to live is under a load. As soon as a baby can walk, he wants to carry something. Ever think of that? Sometimes he may pick up a load too heavy. May get him down, may fall on top of it. But he's happy. Even then, he has something to struggle with. Under your load, you are anchored and growing. You won't drift rudderless. A ship in ballast is an easy prey to winds and waves. A cargo gives her steadiness and aids the ship to safety, helps keep a true course. Likewise, the biggest handicap for a human being is moving through life with no steadying cargo. The young man with responsibilities will survive in shifting economic seas. Without a load, he's liable to sink. A man with no responsibilities flirts with doom. He'd better pick up a load at once. The workers survive. The shirkers often sink. Abraham Lincoln scaled the magnificent summits of greatness, carrying responsibilities too heavy for most men to bear. But Lincoln's heart and soul grew until they were capable of tremendous understanding. The burdens he carried only broadened his shoulders and deepened his great sympathies and tolerance for fellow men. Under his crushing load, he was yet able to lift up a bleeding nation and carry it to peace and safety. Had no burdens been thrust upon him, the great Lincoln might well have never have attained any greatness at all. Young and old are still lifted up by heavy, useful loads. Those who refuse responsibility may grow fat, but they lose the heights of greatness. They come crashing down to valleys of despair, smashed because they carried no load. A life with no burdens is an empty life, a useless life. But differently, those who disdain burdens during youth and middle age will ultimately bear burdens they never chose, despair, and the crushing burden of loneliness. The loads we try to avoid can often smash us. For responsibilities evaded in youth will come the regrets of old age. So when you next begin to feel sorry for yourself, to feel you bear more than your just share of burdens, stop, think, take inventories, be thankful that God has given you the strength and courage and ability to overcome whatever problem arises to confront you. If you have many responsibilities, you're much more fortunate than the man who has none. Don't waste time envying the other man. He deserves pity, not envy. Do you find life interesting, gratifying? Or are you unhappy because there seem to be many displeasing situations in your life? You don't know how to change them. Has it ever occurred to you that what now brings heartache and disappointment, disillusion, even disgust, may perhaps actually be the growing pains of eventual progress and attainment of what you want in life? Get the habit of looking at what now seems disheartening as unpleasant simply as a growing pain. Suddenly things won't appear nearly so difficult. It's amazing. Obstacles can be turned into opportunity. Tremendous opportunity for growth and for happiness. Don't you remember your growing pains of childhood? Don't you remember that finally someone told you those pains in the legs meant you were getting bigger? Yes. And you were. At that time, wasn't the objective of getting bigger your heart's desire? Remember how all at once then the growing pains stopped? And they did. That's part of life too. Why must we take the growing pains of adult life so much more seriously than those of childhood? There's no reason for it. After all, if we take the attitude, that we are stronger than any problem, that any situation contains its solution, it's tremendously effective to us. Our whole life is changed. Yes, the way to grow toward the light is like When Nature Wants a Man by Angela Morgan. When nature wants to drill a man and thrill a man and skill a man. When nature wants to mold a man to play the noblest part. When she yearns with all her heart to create so great and bold a man that all the world shall praise. Watch her method, watch her ways. How she ruthlessly perfects whom she royally elects. How she hammers him and hurts him. And with mighty blows converts him into trial shapes of clay. Which only nature understands. While his tortured heart is crying, and he lifts beseeching hands, how she bends but never breaks, when his good she undertakes, how she uses whom she chooses, and with every purpose fuses him, by every art induces him, to try his splendor out. Yes, nature knows what she's about. When nature wants to take a man and shake a man, wake a man. When nature wants to make a man to do the future's will, when she tries with all her skill and she yearns with all her soul to create him large and whole, with what cunning she prepares him, how she goads, never spares him, how she whets him and frets him, and in poverty begets him, how she often disappoints whom she sacredly anoints, with what wisdom she will hide him, never minding what betide him, though his genius sob with slighting, and his pride may not forget, bids him struggle harder yet, makes him lonely, so that only God's high messages shall reach him, so that she may surely teach him what the hierarchy planned, though he may not understand, gives him passions to command, how remorselessly she spurs him, with terrific ardor stirs him, when she poignantly prefers him. Yes, when nature wants to shame a man and fame a man and tame a man, when nature wants to shame a man to do his heavenly best, when she tries the highest test that her reckoning may bring, when she reins him and constrains him so his body scarce contains him, while she fires him and inspires him, keeps him yearning, ever burning for a tantalizing goal, lures and lacerates his soul, sets the challenge for his spirit, draws it higher when he's near it, makes a jungle that he clear it, makes a desert that he fear it, and subdue it if he can. So doth nature make a man, then to test his spirit's wrath, hurls a mountain in his path, puts a bitter choice before him, climb or perish, so she says. Watch her purpose, watch her ways. Nature's plan is wondrous kind. Could we understand her mind? Fools are they who call her blind. When his feet are torn and bleeding, and his highest powers speeding, blazing newer paths and fine. Yes, when the force that is divine leaps to challenge every failure, and his ardor still is sweet, and love and hope are burning, in the presence of defeat, lo the crisis, lo the shout that must call the leader out. When the people need salvation, doth he come to lead the nation? Thus doth nature show her plan, when the world has found a man. Yes, let me repeat some of this poem, which shows so clearly how important are the loads we bear, how necessary to the growth of our soul. When nature wants to drill a man and thrill a man and skill a man, when nature wants to mold a man to play the noblest part, when she yearns with all her heart to create so great and bold a man that all the world shall praise, watch her method, watch her ways, how she ruthlessly perfects whom she royally elects, how she hammers him and hurts him, and with mighty blows converts him to trial shapes of clay, which only nature understands. While his tortured heart is crying, he lifts beseeching hands, how she bends but never breaks, When his good she undertakes, how she uses whom she chooses, as every purpose fuses him, by every art induces him, to try his splendor out. Nature knows what she's about. When nature wants to take a man and shake a man and wake a man, when nature wants to make a man to do the future's will, when she tries with all her skill, she yearns with all her soul to create him large and whole. With what cunning she prepares him, how she goads and never spares him, how she whets him and frets him, and poverty begets him, how she often disappoints whom she sacredly anoints, with what wisdom she will hide him, never minding what betide him, though his genius sob with slighting, and his pride may not forget. Bids him struggle harder yet, makes him lonely, so that only God's high messages shall reach him, so that she may surely teach him what the hierarchy planned. Though he may not understand, gives him passions to command, how remorselessly she spurs him, with terrific ardor stirs him, when she poignantly prefers him. Yes, when nature wants to shame a man, and fame a man, and tame a man, when nature wants to shame a man to do his heavenly best, when she tries the highest test that her reckoning may bring, when she reins him and constrains him, so his body scarce contains him, while she fires him and inspires him, keeps him yearning, ever burning for a tantalizing goal, lures and lacerates his soul, sets a challenge for his spirit, draws it higher when he's near it, makes a jungle that he clear it, makes a desert that he fear it, and subdue it if he can. So doth nature make a man, then to test his spirit's wrath, hurls the mountain in his path, puts a bitter choice before him, climb or perish, so she says, watch her purpose, watch her ways. Nature's plan is wondrous kind, could we understand her mind. Fools are they who call her blind, when his feet are torn and bleeding, yet his highest power's speeding, blazing newer paths and finer. When the force that is divine leaps to challenge every failure, and his ardor still is sweet, and love and hope are burning in the presence of defeat, lo the crisis, lo the shout that must call the leader out. When the people need salvation, doth he come to lead the nation. Thus doth nature show her plan, when the world has found a man, and every one of us is that man. Friends, you've been listening once again to our message of hope. God bless you, everyone.
Listen again tomorrow, friends, for another message of hope with Richard Eaton. This is UBC, the United Broadcasting Company.
Back in the year 1843, a man was born who, during his lifetime, was to have a profound effect on literally millions of people. His name was Russell Herman Conwell. He became a lawyer, then a newspaper editor, and finally a clergyman in 1881. It was during this latter period that an incident occurred which was to change his life and the lives of countless others. One day a group of boys came to Dr. Conwell at his church and asked him if he would be willing to instruct them in college courses. They wanted a college education but lacked the money to attend. He told them he'd do all he could, and as the boys left, a thought, an idea began forming in Dr. Conwell's mind. He asked himself, why couldn't there be a fine college for poor but deserving young men? Here was a great idea, and he went to work on it at once. Almost single-handedly, Dr. Conwell raised between $6 and $8 million with which he founded the now well-known Temple University of Philadelphia. It was how he raised this money that I want to tell you about. He raised the money by giving lectures all over the country, more than 6,000 of them, and in each he told a story called Acres of Diamonds. This was a true story which had affected him very deeply, just as it affected his audiences. It was the story of a farmer who had settled in Africa. This farmer had heard the exciting stories of other African settlers who had made millions by discovering diamond mines. Realizing the African continent was rich in diamonds, the farmer could hardly wait to sell his farm and search for diamonds himself. He spent the rest of his life wandering the vast African continent, searching for the gleaming gems which brought such high prices on the markets of the world, but without success. Finally, in a sudden fit of despondency, broke and desperate, as I remember the story, he threw himself into a river and drowned. During this time, the man who had bought his farm one day found a large and unusual stone in the stream which cut through the property. It turned out to be a great diamond of enormous value, and then he discovered that his farm was covered with them. It was to become one of the world's richest diamond mines. Now, the first farmer had owned literally acres of diamonds, but had sold them for practically nothing in order to look for them elsewhere. If he had only taken the time and study to know what diamonds looked like in their rough state, and had first thoroughly explored the land he had owned, he would have had the millions he sought, right on the land he had been living upon. What so profoundly affected Dr. Conwell, and subsequently thousands of others, was the obvious fact that each of us is, at this moment, standing in the middle of his own acres of diamonds. If we will only have the wisdom and patience to intelligently and effectively explore the work in which we are now engaged, we will usually find that it contains the riches we seek, whether they be financial or intangible or both. Before we go running off to what we think are greener pastures, let's make sure that our own is not just as green, or perhaps even greener. While we're looking at other pastures, other people are looking at ours. There's nothing more pitiful to my mind than the person who wastes his life running from one thing to another, like the first farmer, forever looking for the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, and never staying with one thing long enough to find it. For no matter what your goal may be, the road to it can be found somewhere in the work in which you now find yourself. It wasn't until he was completely paralyzed, for example, and was forced to reach into the resources of his mind, that a Wisconsin farmer got the idea of producing exceptionally good meat products on his farm, and one of the country's largest meatpacking companies was born. His farm contained acres of diamonds, too. He had just never seen them before. A paper salesman found a dirty drinking glass in his hotel room and gave his company the idea of manufacturing paper cups, an idea that solved his financial problems for life. An insurance man got the idea of going back to all the people in his files and really working with them, serving them the way they should be served. That year, he wrote an additional $700,000 of insurance, made the million-dollar roundtable, and found he no longer had to approach cold prospects, that by working with the people he had already sold and on their referrals, he had acres of diamonds right in his filing cabinet. A man out west amassed a fortune with a single small gas station. In the beginning, when things were tough, he would ask himself each morning, "What can I do to increase my service to my customers?" He still asks that question of himself each morning when he gets up, and while he could have retired years ago a wealthy man, he continues to dominate the business in his area by thinking of new and better ways to be of service. Do you know what the so-called average man would have done in this last case? He would have been worried about how bad business was, because in the beginning my friend had a hard time just feeding his family. When one day a man would have driven in the station in a big, shiny car, this average man, seeing the wealthy customer, would have said to himself, "I ought to be in his business instead of mine." You see, the average man believes some businesses are better than others, instead of realizing the truth that there are no bad businesses. There are just those people who do not know enough to see the opportunities in the work they're in. Jobs don't have futures. People do. No matter what our work happens to be, it's our business. We're its manager. If we can see no future or opportunity in it, it isn't because it's not there, but only because we can't see it. One time another farmer poked a tiny pumpkin into an empty 1-gallon jug. The pumpkin grew until it completely filled the jug and could grow no more. When it was ripe, the farmer broke the glass jug and had a pumpkin which had assumed the jug's exact shape. In life, each of us does a similar thing. We poke ourselves into jugs of our own deciding, and we can grow no larger. But let's be mature enough to realize that it is we who do the poking, not the job, nor the company, nor the territory, nor the economy, nor the times. We do it. We should dispense with limitations and realize there is virtually no limit to our growth and development on the land on which we now find ourselves. Above all, keep this thought in mind as often as you can, on and off the job. Somewhere within the work you are now doing, there lurks an opportunity which will bring you everything you could possibly want for yourself and your family. In closing, here are 12 points to remember. 1. If we will develop the wisdom and patience to intelligently and effectively explore the work in which we are now engaged, we will find it contains the riches, tangible and intangible, we seek. 2. Before we go running off to what we think are greener pastures, let's realize our own pasture is unlimited. 3. That there are no bad jobs, but that it's the way in which we go about our work which makes it good or bad. 4. That we poke ourselves into jugs beyond which we cannot grow. Let's remove the limitations we've set upon ourselves. 5. That only preparation can ensure our taking advantage of the opportunities which will present themselves in the future, opportunities which are around us now. 6. Put your imagination to work on the many ways and means of improving what you're now doing. 7. Learn all you can about your job, your company, and your industry. 8. Since there's no limit to the growth of your industry, it must follow there is similarly no limit on your growth potential within that industry. 9. Our dynamic and growing economy needs and will well reward the uncommon man who seeks a place in this growth. 10. Begin to build your library of reference material pertaining to your company, industry, job, and on how to better serve and get along with people. 11. Set aside an hour a day for this study and research. And 12. Remember the story of the Acres of Diamonds. Zerl Nightingale, thank you.
Give me some. like that. Oh, no, you didn't. Wait a minute. No, you did. Hey, Jay! Hey! Jay! 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 Come back here! Jay! You disloyal, fool-ass, bitch-made punk. Jay! I need my money! Jay! Oh, you motherfuckers. Okay. All right. I'm putting cases on all you bitches. Huh? You think you can do this shit? Jay! You think you can do this to me? You motherfuckers will be playing basketball in Pelican Bay when I get finished with you. Shoe program, nigga. 23-hour lockdown. I'm the man up in this piece. You'll never see the light of day. Who the fuck you think you fucking with? I'm the police. I run shit here. You just live here. Yeah, that's right. You better walk away. Go on, walk away, because I'm going to burn this motherfucker down. King Kong ain't got shit on me.
In 1986, when the Chernobyl disaster sent radioactive clouds all over Europe, we knew we had to do something against nuclear energy. Many parents were really concerned about their children, and so some of us formed a group named Parents for a Nuclear Free Future. We began to educate ourselves in how to save energy. We started in our own home, and then we tried to motivate others to do the same. We wanted the energy company to support us, but they told us no, because we want to sell energy and not to save energy. And so one day we had the idea to take over the grid.
Citizens could generate their own power from solar, hydro, and wind.
Small producers are paid when they feed their electricity into the grid. Consumers are rewarded when they save energy.
So then there was only one question. How do we get the power grid? When the election came up to decide who controls the grid, we knew it was now or never.
EWS, the Shunau Electrical Power Company, held two citizen referendums and won them both.
The power company said, well, you have the votes, but we have the grid. And we want 9 million Dutch mark, and either you pay it or we don't give you the grid. So we had a campaign asking people to help us raising this money.
It took EWS 7 long years to purchase the electrical grid.
This power company was afraid that this was the beginning of a movement, and it was.
Under Ursula's plan, homeowners have small power plants called cogenerators. EWS is now collectively owned by more than 1,000 citizens.
A year after we had taken the grid, the German electricity market was deregulated. Every person could buy electricity from the company he had chosen. And that is the idea of renewable power, because it's decentralized.
This is grassroots at its best. More than 100,000 people now have the electric current from this very small city, and they are very proud of it.
We want to have 100% renewable energy in 2050. All studies say it is possible to do that, and so we will do it.
For outstanding environmental achievement in Europe, the 2011 Goldman Environmental Prize is awarded to Ursula Sladek, Schunau, Germany.
How it go?
We got one out of two of them motherfuckers, you know?
You mean you motherfuckers come strolling in here all walking tall and shit?
Look, yeah, man, I'm saying, man, we was blazing on them dudes, man, you know what I'm saying? Just got in the heat, man. We was blazing, though. It was late.
All right, relax, man. I already heard. Go sit down. I'm not tweaking behind none of this. That's one less motherfucker that's breathing than was yesterday. You know what I'm saying? So we all good. But I'm surprised at you, though, man. Shit didn't get by you back when.
Well, my man's fault, man. I unloaded on the younger too soon, man. Gave him enough room to buck and run, man. I fucked that shit up myself, you know.
Hold on. It's on me. I had that kid in my sights. Close enough to take off his Kango and half his dome with it. Couldn't squeeze the trigger. Couldn't do it, man.
Why not?
Wasn't in me, I guess. You know, whatever it is in you that lets you flow like you flow and do that thing, it ain't in me no more.
All right. So you done soldiering, but you ain't done. Could use you for what you got in your head. We're going to put you on a corner. You could be inside.
Oh, man. I ain't making myself clear. The game ain't in me no more. None of it.
But you ain't done shit else. You know what I'm saying? So what you going to do?
But it can't be this.
All right, then. We straight.
B, he was a man in his time, you know?
He a man today. He a man.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. Workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here, but the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe, but they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time.
今天运动这部主要五金件切料的比较紧急的有哪一些需要我学习的？
This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
那我现在主要是负责是。
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away.
3,000个，赶快送过来。好，这边没有了，已经没有了。是是。
But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock.
因为现在生产线已经停掉了，然后我大概要赶快把它送过去哈。好的。1点钟整是300重量。对对对。
Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day.
好，谢谢谢谢。好。
When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year. But Yupa wants more. Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, where the production runs so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. Ha finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, 6 production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on. Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomen, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly lines. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world.
Yuba is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only two daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work, and there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute, and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of Yupa and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply depot. The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yuba in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
Yuba management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Li is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Li's model, Yupa could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Li's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Li's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Li's shift is done, and when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xing Ming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xing Ming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Li runs one of five independent restaurants at Yuba. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin. And Li needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because UPA-staffed restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop by for lunch. Lee expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, we still didn't have much food to eat.
Now food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced. In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasoning that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at UPA keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy. After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner, determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that UPA and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along. In this factory city, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers. Rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all. Now in his second year on the job, Ya Xin Fu is the manager of Yupa's service department. His job? Address anything that affects the day-to-day life of Yupa's 17,000 workers.
I have to find a balance between the costs of the company and the needs of the employees. Too little and the employees will be dissatisfied. Too much and the company won't be happy, so it's a big challenge.
Keeping Yupa's army of laborers in line is no small task. At this regular weekly meeting, Fu is boosting company morale.
Leading them is like raising children. We have to raise them with love.
Yupa's workers come from every corner of China. Most are in their 20s and 30s. They work on average 40 hours a week and make between 90 and 320 US dollars a month. While wages are even higher in big cities like Shanghai, many Yupa workers make double what they did back home if they had any work there at all. As with any mass organization, thousands of employees create endless demands. It's Mr. Fu's job to address all of them. He does everything he can to keep everyone motivated and committed to staying at the factory of the world. Fu visits staff living quarters as part of his regular rounds.
We're now going to the workers' dormitory. I routinely go there to check if anything can be improved. If there is, I will talk to the superintendent.
Fu is part landlord and part tenant's rights advocate. Today, he's ensuring Yupa rooms are ready for a group of new workers. Average rent is only $6 per month, but the type of accommodation depends on a worker's rank and the amount of money they are willing to part with. Fu is paying a visit to Mao Fen Guo, who has a noise complaint. Fu believes that to build quality products, Yupa's workers must be well rested and well fed.
The challenge is that there are 17,000 employees and they come from all over China. Everyone has different tastes. I have to take care of everybody.
Yupa's restaurants are extremely competitive, and some have been known to skimp on meat portions to keep costs low. Yupa has strict rules about when and where vendors can sell their food. Fu keeps them in line.
Now we are going to check on the other restaurants. We have designated areas for them. If they break the rules, I will kick them out.
These vendors aren't trespassing. They work for the factory's restaurants, but they are breaking the rules by selling food too close to rival restaurants. Everyone must have a permit.
那你们的通行证呢？像这个外滩车，外滩车这个牌呢，在哪里？在下楼道。怎么能在楼上？这个是随车要带着走。
A veteran on these streets, Fu recognizes this woman. He busted her once before.
撤销，会把撤销你，这样是违规。不好意思，没有。你讲多少次了，不能这样。
Today, Fu lets everyone off with a warning. Next time, he may ban them from selling food at Yupa.
I talk to them, but they will break the rules again, so I have to check on them every day.
今天菜怎么样？
China's web of cultures complicates Fu's job.
Everyone comes from different families and different provinces, so their customs of eating and living are totally different, so I have to adapt to them.
But one thing unites all of Yupa's workers, the world's most popular sport. On the field, tension and stress vanish.
Because employees are undergoing a lot of pressure at work, we have to give them an outlet and let them exercise. But most important is the team building.
Don't care for soccer? Yupa offers other ways for workers to get their exercise.
For entertainment, we have ball game competitions like basketball, table tennis, and other games. These sorts of competitions.
It's all part of Fu's mission at one of the world's biggest factories, a place with no boundaries between work and life. For Fu, it's a never-ending battle to keep the peace and to keep the company together.
It really is a miracle, a company this big, with all the employees together, holding hands and moving forward. This is not easy.
And while there may be harmony inside Yupa's walls, outside, competition is cutthroat. In a global market, innovation is key. Yupa's employees must endure tough changes to survive. In the global marketplace, there's no room for second best. To survive, companies need a competitive edge. Like most China-based companies, Yupa has relied on low labor costs, making products designed by others. But it wants to move up the production food chain. Yupa's leaders want to design products of their own. They have little choice. To thrive and survive, Yupa must develop a new generation of products. The factory's very existence depends on it. Thousands of jobs hang in the balance.
No work means not being able to live. This is a fundamental requirement. It's how humans survive. You have to earn money to make a living, and to earn money, you have to work.
Ji Rong Pan knows how high the stakes are. He is Yupa's Vice President of Product Innovation.
I think innovation is the competitive edge of our company. Because our company is in the field of home appliances and the whole home appliance industry is a lifestyle industry.
Mr. Pan sent his staff overseas to study the lifestyle products of the future. They returned with a simple message. The future is green.
We studied the consumers of North America and Europe and their thoughts on this new energy of the future. So we know that their love of the earth is actually very strong.
Pan and his designers make a bold decision. The first appliance in Yupa's new product line will be powered by the sun. It's a solar CD player.
We want to bring this clean solar energy concept into people's homes.
Going solar may sound easy, but solar panels are expensive, and they're meant to work outside, not in the dim corners of people's homes. A 3D image of Yupa's appliance of the future starts to emerge. Now the team must turn a digital design into reality.
This factory is a very important part of our development process. It helps turn a product concept into a finished prototype.
Using the design specs, a computerized milling machine cuts a foam cast. And the cast is converted into a hard plastic prototype. If things go according to plan, the model will be used to produce millions of identical copies.
It allows us to test the product to see if this fulfills our requirements while bringing value to the customers.
Now engineers perfect the solar power system. The system must collect and store solar energy. Every aspect of design must maximize energy efficiency.
We've spent a lot of time studying this. What kind of technology, what kind of material, what kind of parts can help us improve our energy efficiency?
Finally, Yupa's product of the future is revealed. The solar CD player is simple and elegant. The player will charge indoors when left near a window. And the system is uniquely versatile. It will work with any energy-efficient appliance Yupa designs. But one question remains. Will the world embrace Chinese solar products?
We want to bring what people originally thought of as an industrial thing and truly integrate it into their daily lives to enable consumers to truly experience solar energy. This is a very magical energy concept.
If these innovative products succeed, Yupa could achieve its dream, a dream it shares with China, to be the factory of the world.
I want consumers and everyone to have faith in our products and faith in the workers. I hope everyone can enjoy the products we produce. This will make us proud.
With Factory City in full swing and new products in the works, more and more goods will carry the Made in China label. But for China and Factory City, growth comes at a cost. Every day, the 17,000 people at Yupa endure the stress and uncertainty of a cutthroat world economy. To fight off fierce competitors and build a better life, these men and women work and live together as one at the factory of the world.
Today's podcast, it's a holiday today, President's Day, so kind of quiet around here. But we just played Factory City, which we played several times on here before. And the title of today's podcast is House Rent Off-Grid Energy Academy. So let me explain. What is House Rent Off-Grid Energy? And off-grid energy is one word. You can break it up. Oh, yeah, yeah. And then energy. Off-grid. Off-grid energy academy. What is that? Well, it's a trade school that focuses in on the off-grid trades. off-grid building trades and off-grid automotive trades. Now, let me give you the definition of off-grid. Off-grid is, as far as, let's say, housing goes, a house that can generate its own electricity using either solar energy or wind energy. That's off-grid. The house generates its own energy. It also, off-grid is, if you're not tapped, as a matter of fact, off-grid is the dwelling in question, be it a residential house, apartment, what have you. The dwelling does not use any municipal power sources. It doesn't use municipal water. It doesn't use municipal power like electricity, nor gas. We've heard of the building trades, you know, or if you go to trade school, you know, you got the building trades, you got the automotive trades, people that, you know, learn how to repair cars and engines and all that. Well, there's a growing, and it's small right now, folks, but it's growing, niche that the room for growth is tremendous, and that is the off-grid building trades. I would say building and automotive trades. On the automotive side, these are people that are learning how to repair cars that don't use gasoline, electric cars, or in some cases, cars that run off of hydrogen, water. That's where the ball's going. In the United States, you got like 330 million people plus and counting. And out of that, you have probably over 141 million households. People living in houses, you know, apartments, you know, the whole everything that's out there for housing, households. About over 141 million. Out of that 141 million households here in the United States, only about 250,000 households are off the grid. That means they don't receive an electric bill. They don't receive a heating bill. They don't receive a water bill. Many of those homes also don't have a mortgage payment. They're totally 100% off the grid. Yet they can have Super Bowl parties. They can watch Netflix. They can stream anything you can stream. They can listen to anything that you listen to. They have coffee makers, microwaves. Their homes are plenty warm in the colder climates. These homes, 250,000, give or take, are off the grid out of 141 million plus. There's plenty of room there for people who get their skills set up in the off-the-grid, what I call the off-the-grid building trades, the off-the-grid building trades and the automotive trades. People that know how to build an electric car or build an electric bike or repair an electric car or repair a hybrid car, a car that might, like a Prius. A Prius runs off of gas and it generates its own energy too. The new professions that are popping up are in the off-the-grid building and automotive trades. people that know how to install solar panels, people that know how to build an off-the-grid house, people that know how to convert a house that's got hookups into a house that can go off-grid. Take a house that has utility bills 1 month, and the very next month it has no utility bills because they know how to renovate it. So that's where the ball's going. That the professions, the is wide open, people. So if you're looking for a new career, with very lucrative career, look at the off-the-grid trades. Now, once again, off-the-grid building trades and off-the-grid automotive skills, I mean trades. And that's what we shall be doing. That's what HouseRent, that's our school. HouseRent, and HouseRent is one word, and I'll explain the meaning of the word HouseRent or why we picked that particular bird as our mascot and named the school after the bird, HouseRent. And we, instead of two words, HouseRent is one word, HouseRent, HouseRent, one word. HouseRent Off-Grid Energy Academy. The reason why I picked the bird the HouseRent, it's a little bird, is because the male HouseRent is a prolific builder. Before there's mating season, and the mating season in the HouseRent world, the bird kingdom, is from March, that's next month, to late August. In that period of time, the male HouseRent, because there's no mating in the HouseRent kingdom, there is no mating. A female is not going to get together with you unless she first sees the nest that the male HouseRent has prepared, has built and prepared before they hook up. The first thing that the male HouseRent does is he scopes out a territory. Then as he scopes out a territory, he starts building nests using soil local materials. They build anywhere from 5 to 11 nests. Now, this is all before he starts singing and signaling for female wrens to come his way and take a look at what he's got. So once he attracts the attention of a female house wren, which is that, we're down to step three now. She looks at his various nests and she has to find one. Well, she doesn't have to do anything. But if she finds one to her liking, then they mate and produce a generation of the next generation of house wrens. That's how they roll in the house wren community. And I think if humans operated that way, it'd be a less breakups and less couples getting divorced or split up or arguing over money. Because if we built our own, in other words, built our own house, and in the Amish community, they do it. In the Mennonite community, to a high degree, they do it. In a Hutterite community, they do it. Amish are known for going academically grades 1 through 8. And that's it. Now, after that, because most Amish families have a Amish business, a family-based business. And typically they might have at least 2, maybe 3 businesses. The sons might take up learning the side of the business that his father operates. That could be woodworking. So they learn how, this is ninth grade, we're talking about 14, 15 years, they learn how to make furniture, they learn how to make carports, they learn how to build cabins, debt-free with no government programs or no bank financing. They learn how to build tiny houses and some more stuff. That business alone might generate $5 million a year. That's just on that side of it. On the Amish mother's side of the fence, her part of the family business that she owns and operates, and she teaches, we're talking about teaching ninth graders and on up. You know, they might have a bakery. So they know how to prepare everything in there, how to sell it, the whole nine yards, how to run a business. They might make another million or $2 million off of that a year. And what I like about this is Chinese do it too with the carryouts. And the Vietnamese do it with the carryouts. Is that typically in mainstream Western education, people asking you, particularly when you're in 11th, 12th grade, what are you going to do after high school? And typically, people say, well, I'm going to go to college, or I'm going into the military, or I'm just going to get a job. If you notice, most people never mention anything about entrepreneurship or starting your own business and or industry. The Amish, the Mennonite, and the Hutterites, and others, in their culture, that's the way they run it down. So I was thinking, well, you know what's needed? Like I said, I know there are trade schools out here. They might be called vocational centers or career centers. But I said, you know what? There's nobody out here, to my knowledge, that has an off-the-grid energy trade school that focuses in on the off-the-grid skills for housing, or even developing a town, because you can live in a community. There are eco villages around the world, and eco villages are typically small villages where the whole town's off the grid. Yet they have electric. They have all the comforts and conveniences as somebody living in the big city. So, thus, House Wren Off-Grid Energy Academy. And we'll be learning by doing. And we'll be setting up our own villages. And if you want to have your own village yourself, we can help. We can teach you how to do that. Well, that was that announcement. Let's get to the phone lines here. 626, your mic is open.
All right. Grand Rising to you. That was really interesting. The house ran. I think you shared that before. So
The house ran builds anywhere from 5 to 11 nests before there's any romance.
That makes sense. Wow. So
imagine if humans did that.
Yeah. We wouldn't be struggling.
You know, you got 11.
A
woman will not give a guy the time of day unless he's got 5 or 11 nests. Now, let's go with the 11 nests. So let's say you live in one that's debt-free. Then you take, that leaves you with 10. And then out of the other 10, you take 5 and you use those as rentals, passive income. All right? And then you take the other 5 and you sell, you know, you sell those off for cash. You keep a cash reserve. And then after that, basically, you just build 5, you know, like, see, their mating season is from March to late August. So the quicker they get those houses, I mean, those nests built. So I figured that would be a good practice for humans.
Yeah. That's a goal there. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a goal.
August, right. Yeah.
Right. And like I say, there are only 250,000, households in the United States that are off the grid out of over 141 million homes that are on the grid, where they got to pay a water bill, a light bill, and stuff like that. And then another thing, Reba, now what we're going to be doing on here, and hopefully we can get it off the ground this week. And Wednesday, we have a black township mayor that's supposed to be calling in for an interview. And I haven't interviewed one of them in a while. But we're going to have daily projects, and the projects will be something that we can build or assemble within 2 hours or less. It could be a birdhouse. It could be a doghouse. It could be a dollhouse. It could be a she shack, or it could be a tiny house. But something that we can build and assemble within 2 hours and then sell it. So we're not just talking about build it. As we have it built, we want to sell it as well. And tomorrow I'll go into detail on that. So essentially, just by participating in that, people can earn money by partnering with us on It's My House. Because like I said, that we'll have daily build projects. And this is all part of the house rent thing. So it can be, like I said, it's something as simple as a birdhouse, which I think that's a good building block to, you know, all right, get used to working with wood, and then, all right, didn't take that long to put it together. All right, let me step it up. And also furniture. We'll be, we'll have a session where we'll be teaching people how to build furniture. So hopefully by Friday we can get that off the ground. And that's about the latest news I have on this end, here on this President's Day. What do you got on your end?
Well, it's interesting. There's an Amish community in Milwaukee, and my dad noticed how wide the streets are, how clean it always is, and that they, you know, first of all, he said the hats are really tall. I was like, because I did see a family that were picking their children up from school and reading. And they're tall, but my youngest son was just saying the ethnicity of the Moors, of saying Moorish, Amish, Moors and Moorish the same, right? Moorish community.
Now, you're talking about the Moorish, the Nubu-Jaru Ali Moorish people?
Well, he said the original Moors were Mexican. He's just doing a lot of studying and so forth. So,
I don't know. Well, now what they built their own stuff too. I mean, what? Here, no. At one time, everybody built their own stuff. This is just in contemporary times.
Are inclusive with the culture. They have a strong culture, I would say. I guess that's a new term, a strong culture.
Okay.
He said three groups, the Moors, Amish,
Well, that's a hell of a combination there. Morse, Amish?
No, he said the two, it was three ethnic groups. Morse, Amish, and another.
Oh, okay. Now, you say it's the Amish community in Milwaukee, Wisconsin?
Yeah. Nice big old houses.
Or is it outside the city limits?
It may have been in a nearby.
What did you say?
My son is here now. It may have been, do you remember that Morris community?
Let's see. I'm seeing what I can find online. That's a unique combination if they got it.
Yeah, he was saying Moors are Mexican. That's what he was saying. I thought it was.
Originated.
He said they originated from Mexican descent.
Okay. Oh, anyway, let me see. I see an Amish community in Milwaukee, right? Oh, I'll just say Wisconsin. Okay, well, they have the four largest population.
We didn't come here on stage since he's already here.
My son was saying that. Say that again.
We didn't come here on slave ships. We were already here. That's why we don't have no evidence of ancient slave ships from that they say that they brought us here on. We don't have no evidence of them. We just have us and them.
And just pictures.
Maybe pictures, but we don't even know if those pictures are photographed. And
right, if they're real. Okay. So that's
okay.
CJ, brother. Yeah.
Okay.
George Washington said.
He can't hear you.
1751, George Washington said that France, America, and a couple of other more places, there were all 20 people. You look up the word 20. Swarthy or 20. Well, that was somewhere around there. It's supposed to actually mean black. They was talking about us.
Oh, Tawny. Probably Tawny, right?
Tawny or Swarth. Somewhere.
Tawny. Mm-hmm.
Something like that. Actually, it was us.
Okay. George Washington referred to us in 1751.
Swarthy,
yeah.
Swarthy Morris.
Mm-hmm.
George Washington was actually the eighth president. First president was a black man. He's on the back of the $2 bill. He's the more. Sorry, this continues.
Well, you got a lot of Amish out in Wisconsin and Iowa, and I think you got some of more Illinois too.
Okay, yes, I've seen some families here, yeah. And I think it was just the outskirts of Milwaukee, Franklin. I could ask Lawton because he lives there. But he noticed the culture.
Right, I'm looking at
really
a map.
How they dress, the street
I'm
culture.
I'm looking at a map now, and there are quite a few Amish communities in Illinois, Indiana, Milwaukee's got them all. Oh, not Milwaukee. Wisconsin has quite a few, and Iowa has quite a few, and then Missouri has quite a few too. Interesting. Okay.
The more science temple is in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It's more science temple is in Milwaukee.
Okay.
And then I did
see
it may have been a nearby. Yeah, because it's so small. You know, I'm driving. Not like Chicago. Milwaukee is much smaller.
Right.
And the more science stuff, of course, yeah, we do know that they are of hue, of darker hue.
Right. So. Let's see. Noble Drew Ali. I think he's the founder.
Okay.
He was in Newark, New Jersey before he relocated to Chicago.
Okay.
Oh, well, he wasn't a founder. Wait a minute. All right, they say he founded the Morris Science Temple of America. All right.
Okay.
Let's see, lived to be 43. Cause of death, tuberculosis. Yeah, they got a branch down in D.C. I think they still do. He settled in Chicago in 1925, saying that the Midwest was closer to Islam. Let's see, he registered the temple number 9, a year 1926. Let's see. Early 1929, found a conflict over funds. Claude Green Bay, the business manager of the Chicago Temple Number 1, split from the Morris Science Temple of America. He declared himself Grand Sheikh and took a number of members with him. On March 15th, Green Bay, was stabbed to death at a Unity Hall of the Morris Science Temple on Indiana Avenue in Chicago.
Oh.
Drew Ali was out of town at the time as he was dealing with the former Supreme Grand Governor Lomax Bay, or also known as Professor Elzaluddin Muhammad, who supported Green Bay's attempted coup. When Drew Ali returned to Chicago, the police arrested him and other members of the community on suspicion of having instigated the killing. No indictment was shown for Drew Ali at the time. Let's see, death. Sure, this is Noble Drew Ali. Shortly after his release by the police, Drew Ali died at age 43 in his home in Chicago on July 20th, 1929, although the exact circumstances of his death are unknown, the certificate of death says that Noble Drew Ali died from tuberculosis, bronchopneumonia. Despite the official report, many of his followers believe that his death was caused by injuries from the police or from other members of the faith. On that thought, on the others thought that it was due to pneumonia. One more told the Chicago Defender that the prophet was not ill. His work was done, and he laid his head upon his lap. His followers and passed out. His funeral took place on July 25th, 1929, with hundreds attending. The services were held at the Pythian Temple in Chicago, followed by the burial at Burr Oak Cemetery and nearby Islip, Sip, Illinois. The death of Drew Ali brought out a number of candidates who vowed to succeed him. Mealy L. that he had been declared by Drew Ali's successor by Drew Ali himself, while John Gibbons L., Drew Ali's chauffeur, declared that he was Drew Ali reincarnated. Governors of the Moorish Science Temple of America declared that Charles Kirkman Bay to be a successor to Drew Ali and named him Grand Advisor. Legacy here, you see, Wallace Fard Muhammad, the founder of the Nation of Islam, was previously a prominent member of the Moorish Science Temple of America, where he was known as David Ford L. After Drew Ali's death, he claimed to be the prophet reincarnated. When his leadership was largely rejected, he broke away from the Moorish Science Temple, moved to Detroit, and founded the Nation of Islam. Nation of Islam leaders denied any historical connection between the Moorish Science Temple of America until February 26, 2014, when Louis Farrakhan acknowledged Noble Drew Ali's contribution to the Nation of Islam. In 1986, the Moroccan ambassador to the United States officially recognized the Moorish Science Temple Islamic linkage to Morocco through Drew Ali. No. Interesting how people break off from something and start their own thing.
Yeah. Lincoln gave a speech in Milwaukee regarding the advances in the Moorish culture. How even to the study of a blade of grass, they studied everything. Everything was a part of culture to study, to cultivate. Agriculture was it was a major focus for the Moorish community. So I'm sending you this link too that I found. So pretty interesting. I do learn a lot. I don't always get to take notes, but I do take notes when you share.
Right. So, now, are you working tonight?
No. Actually, I'm resigning from the hotel. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm going to focus on my home daycare license and my home daycare and open up a daycare center. Look to start my tax business back up next tax season. And some other things that I could do to focus on building my own. Until I open up my own hotel.
All right.
Don't
want to
stack.
Yeah, that's good. Let's see.
I'm traveling here. So with that, even though I was only working a couple of days, it just was not to be obligated and not really have, like, reliable opportunities to, because I've been there about 6 months, a little bit more than 6 months. So I didn't plan to leave, but plans change, and, you know, my focus is, well, I have my grandchildren, so I may as well license my
kids. Now, you're a grandma times two now, right?
Yeah, and my son, who is a father, his girlfriend has four of her own. So that's six. So that's a small daycare center right there.
Okay, that is. Well, you say you got six?
Well, my son's girlfriend has four.
I see. Okay, I got it. All right. Well, congratulations all the way around.
Thank you. You're
building, so that's a good thing. All right, well, that's it for today. I'll give you a call later on this afternoon about these daily building projects.
Okay, awesome.
With those,
Thank you so much.
You can make money with them.
Yeah.
Okay, everyone have a good day. See you guys tomorrow.